Tonight we will present a one-hour special on The Cradle and the Convert, without interruption. This show is important to people of all faiths regarding the atrocities of World War II, the Holocaust, and the Auschwitz death camp. Listen carefully to our guest's words tonight, and more importantly, listen closely to what she doesn't say.
And now, 88.9 WDCR brings you The Cradle and the Convert, a conversation about local issues with a Catholic perspective. Join your hosts, Dave Slade and Mark Barthelemy, and join the conversation.
Happy Tuesday, everybody. I'm Dave Slade here with Mark Barthelemy for tonight's Cradle and the Convert show. Tonight, we have a very special guest, a guest sought for speaking engagements throughout the country. Our guest is Magda Brown. Magda lives in Skokie, Illinois, just north and west of Chicago. Magda's story that she will share with us tonight begins in Hungary in the early 1940s and is still being written today. You see, Magda is a survivor of the Holocaust. She was held in one of the Third Reich's most notorious death camps in World War II, Auschwitz-Birkenau. Magda is one of the minority of persons to have lived to tell the horrors of Auschwitz and continues to tell the story today. She wants today's young people to hear this story, why she thinks it's happened, and tell us if it could ever possibly happen again. So, Mark, let's say hello to Magda Brown. Welcome, Magda, to the Cradle and the Convert.
Welcome, Magda.
Thank you, and thank you for your kind invitation to allow me to express my testimony and hopefully reach the audiences with a positive way of defending our freedom.
Well, we're very, very honored to have you. I have never personally spoken to anyone who has survived the Holocaust, and so I'm kind of nervous to talk to you. I mean, I'm talking to someone here that's been there and done that. It's amazing. And we just want you to tell us your story, and you can tell it chronologically if you like. And then after you tell the story, we may have some questions for you. But Magda, we're just glad you're here, and you can take it away.
Thank you very much. And as I was introduced, my name is Magda Brown. I was born and raised in Hungary in a devout religious family, loving family, middle class, hardworking people. So my childhood was equal to any of the youngsters of today in the U.S. or anywhere in the world. There was no difference. I was a carefree youngster, and schooling, etc., went just the same as anyone here today. But what happens when the pendulum swings and from this happy-go-lucky child all of a sudden becomes a very grown-up individual? And let me explain the sequence of events. I'm sure your audience is aware of the history of the rise and fall of Hitler in 1933. And he is an evil individual whose desire was to eliminate the undesirables. Mm-hmm. And the undesirables he categorized as the physically disabled, mentally disabled, the homosexuals, some of the Catholics, gypsies, Jehovah's Witnesses. But his ultimate desire was to eliminate the Jewish race. And unfortunately, he pretty nearly accomplished that. Mm-hmm. How did that all work out? In Germany, from 33 to 39 until 1939, he developed what they call the Nuremberg Laws. These are a series of anti-Jewish laws which hits the Jewish people with a brick. That's the only way I can put it to you. It is powerful, it is painful, it is demeaning. Now by 39, the Nazis are ready to occupy the Eastern European countries, and the Nazi military has two units. One is the soldier who fights in the war, shall we say, and the other one is a special unit who is trained to deal with the Jewish issues. Now, I'm going to give you an example. Let's say the Nazi army marches into a big country like Poland, and the special unit of Nazis are to handle the removing of the Jewish population from the country. Step one, they take the people out of their home into a ghetto, from the ghetto into a concentration camp, and thus the killing machine begins. I am living in Hungary. Hungary is an ally of Germany, and as such, the Nazis are staying out of it. So, in comparison to our fellow Jews, our life is certainly much better because we are still sleeping in our own bed. We are up to a point going to school or having our professions. But the Hungarian government adopts many of the anti-Jewish Nuremberg laws, and it hits us one after another. I will cite only a few to make my point. For instance, the military. So the military was where a young man entered the military services, disregarding any religious background, and that was it. Matter of fact, my father was a dedicated soldier, veteran of the First World War, and he was a very patriotic Hungarian. Now, about 1940, at that time, my brother was just about ready to enter the military. He could no longer wear the country's uniform nor bear arms. However, he still had to enter the military. So they coined it the Jewish Labor Force. Now, my brother was outfitted with civilian clothing, just like our kids go to overnight camp, and we sent him off to this military camp. Here, he enters the Hungarian military compound Jewish Labor Force Division, and now he is guarded, supervised, maltreated by the Hungarian military, and where the regular soldier is permitted to go out on a leave or whatever reasons, leaving the camp, the Jewish boys had to have a very, very special pass to leave the area. So this is the military. Then came another one. If you had a larger property, let's say a manufacturing place or big farm or what have you, the government came and took it away. There was no such a thing as, thank God we are used to here, where you exchange a note of promise of payment, what have you, nothing.
They just seized it.
Pardon?
They just seized it from you.
They did. They just took it. That was one phase. Then came another one. Another one hit the professionals who were employed mostly in governmental services. Let's say a scientist, a journalist, a pharmacist, many other professionals, a theatrical director, and a lawyer. The lawyers were not permitted to belong to the Bar Association just because they were Jews. They were practicing lawyers up to that point. So there were all these crazy laws demeaning you step by step. And there are many, many other anti-Jewish laws. But from 39 to 44, we are still in our own homes, which is a large difference from our fellow Jews in the other Eastern European countries. But then in the spring of 44, Hitler decides that Hungary is not doing enough with the final solution, his favorite word.
Mm-hmm.
So the Nazis literally walk into Hungary on March 19, 1944, without the slightest resistance. After all, these are allies. The Hungarian military, the Hungarian police, the Hungarian government welcomes them with open arms. Now, the leader of the Nazi unit is Adolf Eichmann. He is a famous, infamous bad guy. He had so much knowledge about Jewish people, he even spoke Hebrew. And he, with his leadership and his experience of the past 10 years, he is able to organize the movement of the Hungarian people in absolute expedient fashion. Visualize this. They come in on March 19th. In about less than a week, the order comes that we have to wear a yellow Star of David, which has to be sewn on our clothing, and without that, we are not permitted to be outdoors. Hmm. Within another few days, other order. All the Jewish people from the suburban farm areas will be brought into the big city, where they have allocated a section to become a ghetto. And here, when I talk to the children, and I use the word ghetto, you know, in America, we understand that an ethnic group resides in an area, so they call it a ghetto. But thank God they can pick themselves up and move wherever they want. In real life, that wasn't so. So all these people from the areas are brought into the ghetto area. I happened to be born and lived in the house that became the ghetto. It was a comfortable home for the six of us, my parents, my brother, and an aunt and uncle who lived with us. For Hungarian standards, it was a very comfortable home. Now, the Hungarian police had an umbrella group called the Gendarmes. These were the most brutal human beings on this earth, because I recognize the fact that a soldier has to obey his orders. However, when they do it 200% more than what is expected, that is pure brutality, and they exercise us beyond that. What would happen? They would be in charge of collecting the people from the suburban areas. And now, if it was generally within the maybe 5-6 mile area, people would have to walk there. And they have, now you have to visualize something. They move you out of your home and they tell you to pack a little bag with about 3-4 day provision. You walk out of your house and you never ever see anything that was in that house. Visualize your own home, the stuff we accumulate, the belongings, the memories, it's all gone. So now this gendarme marches the people to the ghetto area. And I'm just going to explain one thing that happened to my house. This gendarme looks into my house and makes an executive decision and shoves a bunch of people in. You see, humanity went out of fashion. They don't ask you, would you like maybe your grandma who lived the other town or something to stay with you or any of the niceties. So he looks it over, the area, and now my house becomes the residency for 40 people. Now, if you can visualize turmoil, if you can visualize human behavior in every form, it was there. There were people quiet. There were people praying. There were people cursing, crying. It was a Tower of Babel. That's the only way I can tell it to you. It was horrible. Now, here I am, not quite 17 years old. I had my own house, my own room, rather. I had my own stuff. All of a sudden, my room is people with sitting in every corner they could with their little bag full and in total state of shock because they really don't even know what's happening. So this is where I learned to share. Remember, I had all the clothes and all the what any teenager would have. And there were some girls in the group, so whatever they wanted, they could have. And the people in my house were a bit luckier than the other houses. My father was in a meat market business, and in those days, they used to smoke the meat because it doesn't require refrigeration, so it could be held during the summer. So we had a lot of it in our attic, so we could subsidize some of the very meager, very limited nourishment they supplied us. Once the people were concentrated in the ghetto, there were no more out. The area was fenced off and guarded. So we were, in a sense, imprisoned in our own home. Now, I'm going to cite two events in the ghetto. There were many horrendous things, but two things to make my point. One is, I call it the legal robbery and the illegal robbery. Let's touch upon the illegal first. The Hungarian Nazi Party was composed of a bunch of young, uneducated, hoodlum teenagers. They were paid off, they were riled up, the propaganda was powerful. Kill the Jew, hurt the Jew, whatever fashion you want to do bad, they were riled up to do so. So now here comes the ghetto situation. These young punks have total freedom to walk into the ghetto, go into the homes. Now, for instance, my home was a completely established home for like 40 years. So you can well imagine it had valuables in it. So this person would pick up a silver tray or a painting, whatever of value, walk out with it. Now, I'm not telling you this because he robbed us. That's nothing. I want you to understand that my family goes back to at least five generations living in that same community, being protected by the police until now. Now, the police looks the other way. I am no longer the patriotic citizen. Okay, let's go on to the legal robbery. We are in the ghetto for a very short time, and then comes the order from the government that an agent will come in, and we have to turn over all our cash, all our jewelry, radios, and other valuables. We were too much afraid to resist. Now, you have to recognize one thing here. We have not been working for quite some time already because of taking away our businesses and our jobs. So everybody under those conditions tried to save every penny in case it will be needed to buy a crust of bread. But nevertheless, so we turn over all these things, as I mentioned. Now, why am I telling you this? Because the cash they took from us paid the Hungarian railroad worker to take us to our death. So now, this is just a very brief description of life in the ghetto. This didn't last too long either. By the end of May, we get an order that the ghetto will be evacuated because they need laborers in another country, whether farm, factory, whatever, and they need us. But here came the 20th century's biggest lie. The families will stay together. Now, can you imagine under these conditions, what else have you got left but your family? So we go, we evacuate the ghetto with a small little suitcase, and we have to walk clear across town to the other end of town where there is a brickyard. And we can't understand why in heaven's name did they bring us to a brickyard where there is absolutely nothing there. There's no toilet facilities, there's no kitchen, there's no furniture, zero. Just open land and bricks. But even that was scientifically figured out because the brickyard is adjacent to the railroad track. And on my 17th birthday, on June 11th, they crowded us into a boxcar. The capacity of a boxcar would hold maybe 30 people. Matter of fact, when your audience have an opportunity to visit the Illinois Holocaust Museum in Skokie, there's an authentic German boxcar on exhibit. Look inside, and then you will understand what I'm talking about. So now they crowded in as many as 75 to 85 human beings. There was standing room only. They slammed the door on us. Within, it is excruciating heat because there's just a tiny window for some air to circulate, but the stress and the body heat and so on, and the June heat is horrible. So now they locked the door on us, and It's chaos. It's indescribable chaos. I will never forget there was a young woman with a baby on her bosom, crowded in the corner, just crouched down, and that baby was already dead after a day on the journey. So there were just horrendous inhumanities here. In order to allow my parents to sit down on the wooden floor, I stood for 3 solid days, shifting 1 inch one way, 1 inch the other way. A very unique thing happened to me on this journey. We were gone maybe, we were in transit for about an hour or a little bit more. And we were crossing the beautiful Carpathian Mountains, which separates Hungary and Slovakia. And somehow or another, by that time, I was shifted to the itty-bitty little window, which, by the way, had a wire across,
a grating. Across,
yes. Mm-hmm. So anyhow, I look out, and in the distance, the beautiful lush greenery in this mountainside, I see a shepherd in the distance minding his flock. And I look out, and in my deranged mind, I think to myself, how come he is there and I am here? You see, at that point of my life, I thought the entire world was put into a boxcar. Hmm. So the journey continues. We are going on the railroad tracks, but you see, the war is going on at that point. So many a times we are pushed to the back of the railroad yards. And sometimes through that little window, people would reach out with a little cup to get some water. But people, either they're afraid. I'm not going to analyze. But nobody came near us. Now, on this horrendous 3-day journey, to describe the emotional feelings, there are no words for it. The physical pain. Everything gets pushed to the side because of thirst. You see, when we boarded the train, they had 2 wash buckets, one for toiletry and one filled with water. Except that one bucket of water for 80 people disappeared the first hour. And they have never, ever refilled the water can. So, besides all the emotional stress, the pain of thirst is horrendous. Your mouth is dry, your lips are parched, and your mind is totally focusing, if I could only have a sip of water. After the 3rd day, we arrived to an unknown destination. They opened the door, and some strange-looking men, very emaciated-looking men, in striped uniform, speaking a different language, come aboard. But somehow, by this time, you learn to understand sign language. God knows what happens, but you understand. Well, they were trying to say, exit the train, but leave your belonging in there, because you will get it later. Well, later never comes. Even that last treasure from home is taken away. So now we exit the train. Order is for the men to separate in a separate column, and that is the last time I see my dear father and any of the male relatives who were in my train. Now there are a sea of people lined up. These are old people, women, and children. Now here I have to give you a little statistic to make my point clearer. When I mentioned the fact that they put 80-some people into a boxcar, you see, it would not be feasible to send only one car on a long journey like this. So depending on the size of the community, they would couple together as many as 50, 55 of these trains. So post-war, I read statistics where it explains that Hungary, in 51 days, managed to get 440,000 human beings on these trains, and each transport consisted of naturally several thousand people, And altogether, they have exited 147 of these transports. So now, we are lined up, and we are told to march forward, and all of a sudden, a group of Nazi officers are facing us. And now, again, you know, you're not a human being anymore. They don't talk to you. You don't have a name. They just hold up their hands, which means stop. Okay, we stop. One Nazi officer steps forward, and he points at you. And with a finger, he goes to the right. And my beautiful young mother, who was holding on to me, is directed to go to the other way. So I'll come back and describe afterwards what other way meant. So now I am alone, separated from my mother. And I even waved to her. I said, Mother, I see you later. Unfortunately, later never comes. So now I go through a succession of situations where first they take you into a room and we have to totally, totally disrobe, fold up your clothes, and you will get it later. Later never comes. So even the last stitch of clothing from my home is taken away. From here comes a most horrendous episode for a teenager, because they shave our hair bald and all our body hair. And if that's not bad enough, can you imagine? You know, what does a teenager do but mind her hair prettiness and all that? It wasn't any different then than it is today, which is fine. But the shock is overwhelming. And they shave our body hair, and then they spray disinfectants on it. From here into another room, which laughingly I call the shower. It was nothing more than a room with about 50 shower heads screwed into the ceiling, and literally a trickle of water would be reaching your smelly, dirty body. There was no soap, there was no towel, there was no clean underwear. From here, with the damp body, into another room, and there is a mountain of clothing, all sizes and so forth, and nobody looks at you what size you wear or any of those normal things. They just throw a garment at you. I ended up with a long ball gown slip or something. Shoes were taken away, and instead we were getting wooden sole flip-flops. Horrible to walk in. Now, sleeping time. They take us into this big room, and there is absolutely nothing there, just a wooden floor. And they lay us down like sardines, because the room would hold laying down maybe 200 people, but they scientifically have it figured out that 500 people will fit in there. And sure enough, there are 500 of us laying like sardines in the can. During the night, we are not permitted to go out into the latrines, which is outdoors, but they put some buckets in the corner for bathroom. Okay. The night goes fast. The morning comes at the crack of dawn, in the dirty clothing, in, you know, no toothbrushing, none of the normalcies of our life, thank God, what we have now. You are told to go outdoors. Now here, they have an older prisoner who is now in charge of us. We are a unit of 500. Her job is to line us up five abreast and count us. And now there's no high-tech stuff to count with. There's no calculators, nothing. By hand, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And this counting insanity can go on for hours. To this day, I cannot figure out the logic behind it. Visualize this. We are surrounded by Nazi women guards with police dogs every couple of feet. They watch every move you make. A few yards apart, there are watchtowers with soldiers aiming a machine gun at you. The entire camp is surrounded by electrified barbed wire fence. Where in heaven's name could we have escaped to? But they kept counting us and counting us. And some of these counting insanities would happen 3-4 times a day. Now, once we entered in the morning the sleeping quarters, we were not permitted during the day to go back there, only at night. During the day, we were in the yard. It was like, visualize ants crawling in a small area. That's exactly how it looked. There was not a blade of grass. There was no tree. There was no shade. Many of our blonde colleagues were so badly sunburned because now during the night it's cool, but in the morning it's extremely hot. And there is nothing to do. So anyhow, we are there a couple of days, and we asked some of the old-timers, would you tell us how soon we're going to meet our parents, our relatives who went the other way? Inevitably, they raise their arms, they point the finger to the chimneys, which we have seen since they are there, not far from our camp, spewing out heavy black smoke and having a horrendous odor, like when you kill a chicken and you want to take the feather off and you put it over a flame, you know, that kind of burning smell. But who had time to analyze what that is? So this is what the people tell. That's where your parents are. Would you believe that we could not believe what they were saying? Because we came from a civilized country. This is the 20th century. They don't do that kind of stuff. Unfortunately, it became true. Then we find out that we are in the sub-camp of Auschwitz, which is called Birkenau. Birkenau was built by the management about a year or two before we got there, because they were bringing people in from all over Europe to be killed, but it wasn't fast enough to get them to their crematorium. And this territory where the crematoriums were, they built the camp called Birkenau. And they built it strictly to be an extension to that. Therefore, when you see photographs in exhibits about of survivors sitting on a bunk bed in Auschwitz, we had none of those because we were ready to be killed. That's it. So they didn't bother. That's the best logic I can give you. So now we are facing with this. Hunger is indescribable because our daily calorie, if I tell you, was 300, I exaggerate. And the liquid they gave us in the morning, a horrendously smelling green liquid, that the first day when they gave it to us, the us newcomers were refusing it because we were gagging from it. And the old-timers were begging for it. Of course, later on we realized that if we don't take this, we have nothing. The other torture was, again, very limited water. Sometimes once a day they would bring a barrel of water, and that would disappear in no time. By the way, there was no such a luxury as utensils. They gave us one mug. We had to share it with five people, and that became for everything. And I mean, you use that one mug for every body function imaginable. So we are here for some time, and I mentioned one more important thing of Auschwitz, and that was the daily selection. Selection meant that they would bring out to the courtyard a group, one of these, I call them barracks, like we were in a barrack of 500. So what they did with my group, we had to go out into the courtyard, disrobe halfway, and I guarantee you they were not looking for our sexual beauty, but they were looking how strong our upper arm was, and they would select two columns of people. One column deemed to be very weak, so God only knows what happened to them. I was fortunate enough to get into the other column. So, 1,000 of us Hungarian Jewish women were selected, and in a very expedient time, put on a train and shipped into Stadt-Allendorf, is in Germany, in the general vicinity of Marburg and Kassel. Here, Since 1933, they had an ammunition factory manufacturing rockets and bombs. To tell you that we were mostly young women between 16 and 22, most of us were just in school or never even saw a factory, let alone work in a factory. But you'd be surprised, when it is a necessity, you learn very fast. So here our condition improved a little bit, which meant they put us in an old deserted army barrack, which had individual rooms for about 16 people. So here we had a bunk bed, and we slept on straw, and they gave us an itchy blanket. It had a table and chair, and ironically, it even had a locker, but we had nothing to put in the locker. So now we were lined up, we were delegated into group of night shift and day shift. 1 week we worked day shift, one week we worked night shift. And we had to march about 4 miles each way to the factory. Now here I'm going to say something that the average person have never heard. The factory was built underground. So when the army, when the pilots were, you know, the reconnaissance planes were searching the area, they would see a beautifully wooded meadow because the roof was sodded and were trees planted on it. So no way could they detect that there's a factory hiding underneath it. My job was to fill a highly poisonous liquid material with the bombs. And we were doing this a 12-hour shift, very hard work, very limited food, constantly supervised. And we are working at this job now for about 4 months or so, 5 months. And we look at each other. Now, by now, our hair started growing out to about crew cut size. And some of us had orange hair and yellow face and purple lip. We have found out that the poison started affecting our body because we were working without any protective garments. But thank the Lord, the end was nearing. So by the end of March, the director of the camp received an order to evacuate the camp and march us to Buchenwald, which was the closest big camp. So on the day of getting ready, they gave us a very thin spring coat. And this is what I always tell my audience, that I never want to be cold, hungry, or thirsty again. Because until you experience something like that, you don't know what that really means. So now they put us on an open highway. And we marched for 3 days on an open, bitter cold, rainy March weather. During the night, we slept in the ditches on the cold, wet ground. On the third day, we arrived to an area that was like a village, but mostly the farm section where we got there. So we saw all the farmland, and in a distance, we discovered a barn. And at the same time, we have noticed that there were not as many Nazi women guards escorting us as we started out with. Evidently, they must have been taking off to go back to their homes. Who knows? I don't know. So now we are standing and looking in a far distance to that barn. And you see, we lived in fantasy. That's a very important point, to keep our sanity. Because otherwise you couldn't make it. So the group of us merged and start looking at this barn and start fantasizing. How would it be if during the night, one by one, we crawl on the ground and try to make it to the barn? You see, when you are at that age, you're either smart, brave, stupid, or all the above. The point here is really that we have lost our self-esteem. So if they find us, they kill us, it will be all over. But the good Lord was with us. And during the night, about a dozen of us attempted and succeeded to make it to the barn. Needless to say, we were shaking in our boots because who knows, you know, if they are, we are found, that that's the end. But the next day, we look out through a little peephole, and we see two men walking towards us. They wore a strange uniform. It turned out to be two scouts from the 6th Armored Division of the U.S. Army. God bless them all. And they were our liberators. So, to tell you that moment, there are no words for it. Those boys were crying as much as we were crying. Fortunately, among our group, some of them spoke English, so it was an easier communication. And from that point on, then we were under the 6th Army's jurisdiction, so they were the ones who arranged housing for us temporarily for a time being. So, when I go through telling my testimony, I emphasize one thing, and that is, to protect your freedom, because slavery is horrible. And thank God we live in a country where freedom is practiced, so let's do everything in our power to keep it going. And secondly, I tell usually the children, think before you hate. I am not telling you to hate or not to hate. That's up to your conscience. But at least think about, why do I hate so-and-so? And of course, every other day, some individual comes up denying the existence of the Holocaust.
Yes.
And this is it's in a sense, it's a laughable situation. Why? Because today we are surrounded with high tech. You push one finger on that computer, and you punch in Auschwitz. You punch in Holocaust. You punch in museum. It's there. It's authentic stuff. And that's the same that I encourage your audience to visit our museum in Skokie, because it will come alive, all the things that I've been talking about. They have a fantastic exhibit of the past, and their slogan is, remember the past and transform the future. So I think that I covered pretty much what you would like to hear.
Absolutely, Magda. I think we're just speechless.
Overwhelmed.
It's hard to. It's we can't get our arms around what happened to you. It's just, and like you said, as a youth living a normal life the way we do now, basically, that these things can happen because of the reduction of freedoms in Hungary that began a little at a time. Now, were you able to practice your faith while you were in Hungary before this happened?
Oh, my goodness. I grew up in a very religious, Orthodox Jewish family. We kept the Sabbath, and I went to a school that was sponsored by the Jewish Federation. I mean, we had regular Hungarian curriculum, but every hour we had religion. And on Sabbath, we had to go back to the school for services. And yes. I mean, the religion was part of my life.
And some of the other freedoms that slowly were diminished, were you able to purchase food or medicine, that type of thing, as this began? Did they begin to take that away from you as well?
Are you talking about the medicine during the camp?
No, when you were still, before you'd been interred.
At home?
Yes. You were able to buy what you needed prior to internment?
Well, certainly. I mean, are you talking about before Hitler's invasion?
Yeah, just as it began, when they began to take things away from you.
Things were taken away slowly.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, to define individual items, let me step back for one important thing, how they hurt us. You know, the small laborer, the barber, the dressmaker. Mm-hmm. In order for them to practice their profession, they had to have a license, right?
Right.
In the towards when these anti-Jewish laws were happening, they would not issue a license for them to practice. So they really took even the bread out of their mouth. You know, there was no big property back to back them up or anything. So there were many things. But as far as purchasing things, yes, we could. I can't recall any restrictions there at that time.
Okay. Now, Magda, one of the questions that I have is difficult even for me to ask, but have you been able to forgive those who imprisoned you and mentally and physically tortured you and took so many of your relatives from you? Have you been able to come to grips and forgive them?
I tell you, I stand in front of audiences and I preach, don't hate. So, in my heart, I turn this around in a different fashion. All those Nazi guards and people involved with all these atrocities, they were still human beings, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I often wonder, after the war, we all had nightmares.
Mm.
I wonder how many nightmares they had, especially the ones who were right in Auschwitz, because they had a nose to smell the burning flesh. They had the ear to hear the crying, and they had the eyes to see what was going on. So I don't care if they are the perpetrators or the good guys. It was there for them to see. So they had to wrestle with their conscience. So that's the only way gives me peace to know that as human beings on this earth, they had a way to suffer.
And I know over the spring and summer, you've been following the trial of Oskar Gröning, a former Nazi SS guard at Auschwitz. It's charged with 300,000 murders, mainly of Hungarian Jews at the death camp. Has that trial ended, Magda? And what are your feelings in particular about Oskar Gröning?
Well, I think that, let's approach this from the legal angle. I think it's 70 years too late, but it's never too late. Let's put it that way. And the German jurors decided to carry on this trial, and I am very proud of them for doing it to set precedents for future if, heaven forbid, it ever happens again. So from that aspect, I'm fine. The gentleman is 94 years old, so naturally he was brave enough to withstand all the events at the trial. But let him be well. I mean, he cannot be put to jail. I mean, that would be inhuman. So anyhow, you know, life is funny. We have to deal with our own conscience. So let them deal with their conscience. That's the only way I can do it.
Thank you, Magda. I've got so many wheels turning in my head. You mentioned living in fantasy was, I guess, an escape method, a mental escape method, so that you didn't have to focus on all the atrocity that was going on. Did your faith, did your strong Jewish faith, did it help you at all throughout this?
Well, in a roundabout way. Now, among us were some older women. Now, when I say older women, they could have been maybe 28, 30 years old,
mm-hmm.
who came from an ultra-religious background. And for me, I have no idea how, but they knew when it was Sabbath, they knew when it was a holiday. Now, we had no way to congregate because they would not allow us to merge and just be, you know, grouped together, except by the latrines. Behind the latrines, we could hide, and that's where we would say our prayers.
Wow.
So I think that tells you how faith was kept.
Absolutely.
And God has been very good to me. and I'll tell you why. A, I had the good fortune that my brother remained alive. Mm-hmm. And that was the only immediate family, except six cousins, that's all. So from the extended family of 70, six of us survived. So that's a miracle.
It is a miracle.
And then the other miracle is that I always thank every single volunteer on this earth, because you cannot reconnect with normalcy without somebody helping you. And I can cite you a number of special reasons. I'll tell one. While we were still in Germany after liberation, the Jewish chaplain from the army interviewed us, asking what our future is, what we are, where we would like to go back to our hometown or whatever. Among his questions was, do you have any relatives around the world? And I remember that my father had two brothers and a sister who emigrated to Chicago in the early 1900s, like 1908 or something. The only thing I knew was their name and Chicago. Huh. Now you have to think back 1945. There was no cell phone, Skype, etc. A telephone was very expensive. So that chaplain forwarded this information to the Hebrew Immigrant Society in New York, and some dedicated volunteers kept trying Chicago till they found my relatives, who were elated because I was the first living person that they heard about from the family, and they saw to it that I could come to the country. And by September of 46, I ended up in Chicago, and wow. I became a U.S. citizen, and I married a Chicago-born nice Jewish boy. And unfortunately, my brother had a sadder story, because from this Jewish military that I told you earlier, when the war, when the Russians were ready to liberate Hungary, the Hungarian military was trying to escape into Austria and Germany. This is like January of 45, and they were dumping the Jewish boys in different concentration camps in Austria and Germany. But my brother's unit could not cross the border anymore. The Russians come in. My brother thinks he's a happy person, free, goes on the street. The Russians imprison him, and they take him out to Archangels in Siberia, and he works with the Nazis and Hungarian soldiers. So the Russians didn't care who you were. They needed manpower, because they lost 20 million people in the war. So my brother ends up in this horrible prison camp in bitter cold, and unfortunately, they had to cut down trees. It was a paper mill. They had to cut down trees in the swamps. He gets bit by a mosquito, develops malaria, no medication, and it takes until 1948 that he ends up returning to Hungary as a very sick, sick man. And at that time, U.S. is in Cold War with the Russians, so I couldn't get my brother here until 1962.
My.
So there are many, many goods and bads.
Well, Magda, your story is just incredible. We can't thank you enough for sharing
Absolutely.
It with us. I'd like to make a little push here for the Illinois Holocaust Museum and Education Center, which is located in Skokie, Illinois, and it honors the endless contributions of Holocaust survivors. Today's generation is likely the last to have the privilege of hearing from survivors like Magda about their experiences firsthand. However, the museum continues to add survivors to its speaker bureau, and is dedicated to training a second-generation family and storytellers in order to preserve the survivors' stories for generations to come. And if you want information on that, you can go to www.ilholocaustmuseum.org. Magda, we don't know what else to say, but thank you for sharing your stories with us.
And that incredible. That seems so shallow to say thank you. I mean, my heart is heavy. I'm overwhelmed, honestly.
Thank you all for listening and giving me the opportunity, and I hope that all the listeners will visit us in Skokie.
Well, we're going to recommend it, and I'm going to certainly make
Absolutely.
My best effort
yep.
to get up and
me
see
too.
It. So that wraps up our show for this evening, folks. Thanks for joining us on tonight's Cradle and the Convert. and we'll talk to you next week.
The Cradle and the Convert is a production of WDCR Decatur Catholic Radio.
You know, I'm sure you've heard it said, the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. I think tonight's story explains to us what happens when good men do nothing. Thank you for listening to this very special show tonight on The Cradle and the Convert. On behalf of Mark Barthelemy and myself, we want to thank you for listening. We welcome all your comments on this show or any show. You can call us at 464-1099. 464-1099 or email us at contact@wdcrradio.com. contact@wdcrradio.com. God bless you all and good night.